Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's call on strengthening accountability for traditionally underserved students within the reauthorization of the elementary and secondary education arts. This call is being hosted by the Alliance for Excellent Education. We are pleased to have on the call Congressman Bobby Scott from the Virginia's 3rd Congressional District and ranking member of the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Education and the Workforce. The conversation will be moderated by Bob Weiss, President of the Alliance for Excellent Education and former Governor of West Virginia. Following the discussion between Governor Weiss and Congressman Scott, the call will be open to questions from listeners. This call is open to the press and will be recorded. The recording will be available on the Alliance website within the next several days. Let's begin with Governor Weiss.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. I'm Bob Wise and want to welcome you to a special conversation with Congressman Bobby Scott on the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, now known as No Child Left Behind. I had the privilege of serving with Congressman Scott for a number of years when we both served in the House, U.S. House of Representatives. He has gone on to become the ranking member, the lead Democrat, on the House Committee on Education and the Workforce. Congressman Scott represents the 3rd District of West Virginia. I'm sorry, Bobby, the 3rd District of Virginia. That's old habit.
A district. I didn't think that redistricted that far.
It almost did in 92, but at any rate, Congressman Scott represents the 3rd District of Virginia and is the first African-American elected to Congress from the Commonwealth of Virginia since Reconstruction. He is serving his 12th term in Congress. He is a passionate advocate for education and sees educational equity as a critical component in the effort to dismantle the school-to-prison pipeline. In his key role as ranking member, Representative Scott serves as the lead House Democrat on ESEA reauthorization. Today's conference call will focus on strengthening accountability for traditionally underserved students within the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, or ESEA. I'm going to begin by posing a few questions to Congressman Scott. We will then open the call to questions from listeners. So let's start with a quick review of the state of play in Congress. Representative, what is the status of ESEA at this point?
Well, thank you, Governor Wise, and it's a pleasure to join you and the Alliance for today's call, and I want to thank you for all that you did as a member of Congress and as governor in terms of education. You're certainly a leader, and you're continuing to be an excellent leader in education and making sure that all children get a quality education. One of the things that we're hoping to do is reauthorize ESEA. The bill expired 8 years ago, but we don't just need any ESEA reauthorization. We need an ESEA that honors the legacy and intent of the original Elementary and Secondary Education Act. Education as a civil right for all children, particularly those who've been historically underserved. Now, in 1954, the Supreme Court in Brown v. Board of Education recognized the importance of quality education and asserted that educational opportunity must be available to all on equal terms. But we know that those who need the most don't get the most because state and local funding for education has always been unequal. It's funded primarily through the real estate tax, which virtually guarantees that wealthier areas will have more resources than low-income areas. And ESEA recognizes the challenges of educating communities with high concentrations of poverty and sought to provide an increased funding to communities that need it the most. Now, the House Education Committee passed a partisan ESEA bill earlier this year that not only reduces funding, but changes the funding formula to the detriment of low-income areas. And if that's not bad enough, it fails to require any corrective action when achievement gaps are found by virtually removing the federal focus from underserved students and providing little, if any, support for low-performing students and the schools and educators that serve them. Now, when you asked about the status, we considered the bill on the floor a couple of weeks ago, and late in the consideration, it occurred to the House leadership that they didn't have the votes to pass the bill, and it kind of dissolved, and we're not sure what's going to happen. They keep saying that they are developing the votes to pass it, but it was supposed to come up last week. It was supposed to come up this week. Maybe it'll come back the following week. We're not exactly sure. But the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, the Health Committee, had a more bipartisan process and has come up with a much better proposal. It still has, it's not perfect, it still has some flaws, but it fixed the funding problem. But one of the problems is the what we're calling accountability. It will expose achievement gaps, but unfortunately it doesn't have a meaningful requirement that the achievement gap be corrected. The Congressional Tri-Caucus, that's the Congressional Black Caucus, Hispanic Caucus, and Congressional Asian and Pacific American Caucus all sent a letter to the Senate leadership that articulates the concerns with the current bill and noted that virtually every civil rights advocacy group views accountability as an essential element of any meaningful reauthorization. So I remain hopeful that these concerns can be addressed as the process moves forward.
Congressman Scott, as you've mentioned, you and a number of civil rights and education organizations, including the Alliance, have raised serious concerns regarding the direction of the current ESEA reauthorization. Could you give us a summary of your major concerns?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Fundamentally, I'm concerned about the erosion of the federal role generally. Some argue that No Child Left Behind swung the pendulum too far in the direction of federal control, but unfortunately the reaction to both the House both the House Republican proposal and the Senate proposal swing the pendulum back so far that accountability has been left behind. No Child Left Behind recognizes that the performance of underserved students matters. They, for the first time, we really actually exposed where the problems were. Under No Child Left Behind, you couldn't hide low reading proficiency rates of African-American students with an overall average. We know, for example, on average, a school may be doing well, but you have a huge achievement gap. Well, one of the things that No Child Left Behind exposed was the achievement gap, that you're educating some children, but not others. But now that we have to get a balance, we need to ensure that the performance of underserved students is not masked and action is taken to address achievement gaps. And while providing some reasonable flexibility to states and districts regarding interventions and supports when data shows challenges persist. And we have to continue to use the data to identify shortcomings, including poor performance of subgroups. That's where the discussion really ought to start, not end. As farmers tell us, you don't fatten a pig by weighing the pig. The key in a meaningful ESEA is not just testing and discovering achievement gaps, but what you do next. And that's the accountability that we're talking about that's missing in the Senate bill. And so we need to know how greater educational equity can be achieved, not only by measuring the problem, but doing something about it. And that's where accountability, that's what accountability means from the civil rights perspective. Now, the House ESEA reauthorization bill completely removes the federal government from accountability. The Senate bill provides a kind of loose framework, but it really lacks a true accountability and civil rights safeguards for what is intended to be a civil rights bill. And so the Senate really stops at the measuring of the problem without insisting on credible action to be taken to correct it. And that's really what the concern is.
So in the letter that you mentioned a few moments ago, over 80 members of the Congressional Black Caucus, Hispanic Caucus, and Asian and Pacific American Caucus, also known as the Tri-Caucus, joined you in expressing opposition to the Senate's bill in its current form and called for specific improvements to the Senate bill. When the full Senate does address the ESEA, possibly as early as next week, what changes to their bill are you and the Tri-Caucus looking for when it comes to accountability?
Well, we're delighted with some of the improvements made over the House bill, but we're asking for a federal policy that ensures that students will receive support if they're not progressing in school. There's no doubt that we've seen improvements in student performance over the past several years. For example, the high school graduation rate has reached an all-time high of about a little over 80%. So that's the good news. 80%, 4 out of 5 students are graduating. Of course, the bad news is 1 out of 5 students is not graduating. Can we really applaud ourselves when 20% of the students are not graduating from high school, particularly when we know that dropping out of school and failing to graduate really puts you on a trajectory that involves all the bad things that can happen to people, criminal justice, teen pregnancy, welfare dependency, unemployment, all the bad things happen when you drop out of school. And when 20% are headed in that direction, that's nothing we can brag about. We also have to note that the achievement gap is alive and well in dropping out. African American and Latino students drop out at a much higher rate. So now is not the time to celebrate. It's time to concentrate. We must focus our efforts on those who have historically been underserved in our schools, and that's what the Tri-Caucus is advocating. We must ensure that targeted, locally developed interventions and supports are provided when students of color, low-income students, and students with disabilities, and English learners and native students miss a state-set performance goal for achievement or graduation rates for 2 or more consecutive years. We must also ensure that high schools failing to graduate a third of their students, better known as dropout factories, implement some kind of comprehensive reform. There are a little over 1,000 of these schools across the country. They disproportionately serve low-income students and students of color. And if we concentrate on them, we can make quite a dent on the problems that we're addressing. Those are schools that fail to graduate at least a third of their students. In addition to the dropout factories, federal law must also require states to identify a bottom tier of chronically low-performing schools for comprehensive reforms. That's one number that's being used now. It's the bottom 5% of schools need particular attention. But we don't want to limit our focus on that 5% because obviously 95% of the students go to the other schools and you don't want to leave them out. But we do believe that it's the responsibility of Congress to set expectations of actions that states and districts do something to improve schools that aren't preparing students for college or career. Now, it's not like No Child Left Behind where you have a cookie-cutter response. We're counting on the states to come up with a credible plan to deal with the achievement gaps, but it's up to them to come up with it. We're not telling Montana and Florida and Texas that they got to do exactly the same thing, but we do insist that a credible plan be developed to do something about the achievement gap. And finally, I'd like to see a bill strengthened not only to drive additional resources to schools that need it most, but also require states to reserve dollars for improvement and support activities. The ESEA should be a federal level that encourages states and districts to do more to equitably allocate resources to meet the needs of all students. Too many states' funding formulas are outdated and inequitable, and new ESEA must require states to invest in the schools that need it most.
So you covered some important points there on the high school graduation rate. Just to note that only 6% of the nation's high schools are those schools that are graduating less than two-thirds of their students, as you point out. So this is a problem we can do something about. There is one when the Senate language, though, if it only addresses the bottom 5% of all schools, that won't reach most high schools. We've seen this historically in the past because there are many more students in elementary schools and middle, and there are many more elementary schools and middle schools that will be in that bottom 5%, and then so high schools will get overlooked. So we're very grateful for your recognition of the need to not only measure students in the school, in the grades where they are, but also to measure the end game, whether or not they're actually graduating. And that's what that, of course, amendment would do. You also touched on something else that I'd really like to drill down on more, and that's subgroup accountability and accountability for low graduation rate high schools are two policies that hopefully everyone can support. I've heard some say that these policies sound like adequate yearly progress, the old adequate yearly progress under No Child Left Behind. Can you explain to us how these policies differ from AYP and the No Child Left Behind law?
Well, one thing I think nobody, including the Tri-Caucus nor the civil rights organizations, are asking for a return or a continuation of AYP. There are some major differences between improvements which we're advocating and the No Child Left Behind accountability. First, AYP was based on a federally required unrealistic target and timeliness. The accountability proposals championed by civil rights are just like the Senate's bill, wants to use state-determined, this is what we want to do, use state-determined goals for academic achievement and graduation rates. So it's not federally prescribed, it's state-prescribed. And second, the interventions should be implemented under the proposal championed by civil rights groups, which would be evidence-based and responsive to the needs of individual students, but the interventions themselves would be determined at the local level. This is a major difference from No Child Left Behind, where if a school missed AYP, it was placed into a matrix of inflexible, federally required interventions. Schools were required to spend exactly 20% of their Title I funds on school choice and tutoring, then had to implement corrective action and restructuring if the school continued to fail in AYP, even if the interventions didn't even address the cause of the problem. The one-size-fits-all had some responses to failure, not even addressing the failure. We can do better than that. Another problem with AYP was that if third-grade African-American students missed a reading target 1 year, and then next year fourth-grade Latino students missed a math target, they would have failed 2 years in a row. Well, with our proposal, we're talking about ensuring interventions when the same group of students continually miss the state set performance goals, so that your response can be addressed to what exactly the problem is. Under No Child Left Behind, we got the interventions wrong. They were inefficient, didn't even apply sometimes to the problem. The law was too prescriptive and treated all school challenges, regardless of the severity, exactly the same. That said, the expectation of acting to meet the needs of students for whom there had previously been no action, we can do better than that. So I'm advocating a better approach, and that is one that maintains an expectation of action, but let the state and local leaders determine what that action looks like. But we don't want to have a situation where you can report an achievement gap and then nothing happens.
So I just thank you for that explanation, and I completely agree with you. What you're emphasizing is, I think, key flexibility and fairness, flexibility for the states to determine their own interventions, and at the same time, fairness for all students, so that all students know that they're going to be looked at, and that if something's not working in their behalf, that there'll be interventions by the states to protect them. We need to provide the states the flexibility on what interventions are implemented, but also critical that is federal policy ensure that schools with low-performing subgroups are identified. From your perspective, what do we risk if the law does not require action in response to low achievement among traditionally underserved students and low graduation rate high schools?
Well, the problem is that you can report an achievement gap and do nothing. That's what we've been doing for 50 years. I did the term achievement gap isn't a brand new concept. People have been knowing about achievement gaps for years and nothing has happened. So if we don't include critical protections for students, the progress that we have made in graduation rates and academic achievement could erode, and flaws that have already been identified in state accountability systems will continue or maybe even get worse. For example, the Education Trust has documented how student subgroups are getting overlooked and underserved in some accountability and state accountability systems. In Florida, for example, 58% of African-American students are proficient in reading in schools that received an A rating. How can 58% of the students be proficient, only 58% over 40% not proficient, and you give the school an A rating? Most of score scales have 58, not an A, but an F. And also in your organization, the Alliance of Excellent Education found that 14 states either do not include subgroup graduation rates at all in their accountability systems, or subgroup graduation rates for such a small portion of the accountability system that even dismally low subgroup graduations never trigger a response or any action to improve. And that means that in each of those schools, the expectation of action to ensure that the needs of all students are met has been taken away from parents and communities. Does it matter if the African American students as a group aren't achieving, if the entire school is on average doing well? I think it does matter. I think everybody ought to be progressing, and a federal policy should be clear that it matters if a subgroup is not progressing, that something needs to be done. We should not allow school systems to notice an achievement gap without ensuring that they have a credible plan to do something about it. And so we need to make sure that ESEA is not the time to abandon the challenge. We must double down our efforts and address the achievement gaps head on. The Alliance found in one report that there are 1.1 million students enrolled in dropout factories in Virginia. They're low graduation rate high schools. They enroll over 10,000 students. Less than a quarter of the K-12 students in the Commonwealth are African American, but African Americans make up 3/4 of the students attending these dropout factories. Now, under the Senate bill, there's no obligation to identify the intervention and support to fix the situation. Now, it matters, and you just can't ignore a subgroup achievement gaps. And the intent of the law is to serve students typically left out and ensure that all students graduate college and career ready. And for all the problems of No Child Left Behind, it was successful in forcing systems to act on based on needs of historically ignored student populations. Unfortunately, it was over-prescriptive, and many of the responses, as I indicated, weren't the most efficient ways to address the problem. But we have to improve that. We have to continue making improvements on what the response is, but we have to have a credible response. ESEA reauthorization provides us the opportunity to ensure that these flaws in state accountability are fixed and that all students are given the opportunity to succeed. We need to simply insist that when shortcomings are found, something gets done.
Thank you, Congressman Scott. I would now ask our host operator to open the phones for questions from today's listeners, and I know that we have folks that are already queued up.
Thank you. If you'd like to ask a question, simply press the star key, followed by the digit 1 on your telephone keypad. Also, if you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on your phone line will indicate when your line has been opened to ask a question. We ask that you please state your name prior to posing your questions. Once again, star 1 at this time. We'll pause for just a moment. And we'll first take our first caller. Please go ahead.
Hello. Hi, this is Ariana from Iowa. I wanted to ask Governor Wise, where does the 67% graduation rate threshold come from?
the threshold rate comes from the fact that those are schools where that fail to graduate a third or more of their students. Initially, if you recall, there was a report issued by the Institute of Johns Hopkins. Everyone graduates several years ago. Congressman Scott referred to dropout factories, and these are schools where 60% or more failed to graduate. We have made progress, as Congressman Scott notes, that the overall graduation rate has moved up to 81%, although there's still some deficiencies, and there's a large group of schools that hang between, they got over the 60% graduation rate, that's good, but they're hanging in there at 61% or 62%. And so the thought was, you ought to be able to graduate, do better than having a third of your students or more fail to graduate. And so that's where the 67% comes from. It's the congressman noted there are 1,235 schools in this country. They represent 1.1 million students. They're about 6% of all high schools, and these need to be clearly the target of interventions at the state level, at the local level, but they need to be identified and dealt with. So that's where the 67% comes from.
Next caller, please go ahead.
Hi, this is Luis Torres with LULAC, and my question is for Congressman Scott. You raised the need for interventions to be triggered when students miss performance goals. Now, my question is, under your proposal, would schools be required to implement interventions that include replacing teachers and principals, like under the Department of Ed School Improvement Grant Program?
No, the specific models required under our proposal eliminated the specific proposal is that the local governments come up with the response. We're trying to get away from the cookie cutter idea where you have the same response. It's so bizarre. If you have a failing school because the English learners weren't learning, well, other students can get supplemental educational services, and other students can slip out the back door of school choice, and that's your response, and you did nothing for the English learners. We need to make sure that, one, the response addresses the problem, but that response will be locally determined. You have to come up with a credible plan, and that plan may be different in Montana than Florida than Texas than New York, but it has to be a credible plan to do something about the problem that you've discovered.
And we'll take our next caller.
Hi, Mr. Scott, I have a question for you. My name is Marcia. I'm from Maryland. So one of the critiques of NCLB is that the interventions were one-size-fits-all. So I'm curious, how do you propose to ensure that interventions are more appropriately aligned for students specific needs of students, teachers, and schools?
Well, as you've indicated, the one-size-fits-all doesn't work. And by using the locally tailored, credible plans, the local government will come up, the local schools will come up with their plan to fix their situation. So long as it's a credible plan and it's actually, as time goes by, it's working, that's what we're looking for. We don't want a plan that may fit the cookie cutter response, but didn't even address the problem. And so idea, and this is what the civil rights groups are insisting on, that you have some credible response to the to failure in subgroups, a credible response, locally tailored, to get the job done. And I think if we do that, the fact that it's locally tailored means that it not only addresses the problem, but it's something that the local government has come up with, And so it's more likely to work than something that's handed down. Here's what you got to do, whether it works or not. And so everybody feels that this is a much better way to go. But you have to have a credible response. You just can't publish your achievement gaps and stop there.
And we'll take our next caller. Please go ahead.
Hi, Mr. Scott. I'm calling from New Hampshire, and my state only has one high school with a graduation rate below 67%. Under your proposal, what would happen in my state if that school improves and has a graduation rate of, let's say, 75%?
Well, if you had no school below 67%, then those schools would not be part of the identification process. It would be great if no schools had qualified under the 67%. But if there are no other high schools with graduation rates below 67%, then the state would not be required to identify any low graduation rate high schools. We need to make sure that we still need to make sure that the student subgroups are meeting the state's graduation rate goals. So if you had all the schools with appropriate graduation rates, but some subgroups, either low-income or minority students or English learners, were not graduating, you would have to address that. But in terms of whole schools, you wouldn't have to address the any schools if you had no schools below 67%.
Next caller, please go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thank you both for talking to us today. I guess my question is for Governor Wise. Is it too late to intervene and turn things around in high schools?
Absolutely not. And indeed, what we're seeing across the country is we're seeing high schools that truly are turning around. And indeed, if you look at the high school graduation rate, that those number of dropout factories have dropped sharply. The overall graduation rate has moved up to, after 40 years of being dormant, the overall graduation rate has moved to 81%. So there's an upward trend, and it shows that where people are determined and concentrate their efforts, they can make a difference. But as Congressman Scott said in the beginning, we can't be sanguine or complacent because the graduation rate, we now have schools that, we have 1,200 schools that graduate a third or fail to graduate a third or more. And so in today's economy, and incidentally, that's 1.1 million students in those schools and a disproportionate number of students of color and low income. And so in this economy, they're vitally important. And so that's the importance of recognizing that gains are being made. Now we have to continue them, not step back.
Next caller, please go ahead. Caller, your line is open. If you can release your mute function, we are unable to hear you.
Hi, Mr. Scott. This is Kim from CIRAC. I'm from Florida, and I'm pleased to know that Florida's graduation rate has increased over the past 3 years. However, while the overall graduation rate has gone up, the graduation gap between limited English proficiency students and their peers has widened during this time. The overall graduation rate in Florida is 75%, but for students with limited English proficiency, their graduation rate is 57%, nearly 20 percentage points lower. How can ESCA more effectively address the needs of English learners?
Well, this is exactly the problem where you have an average that covers up the fact that a subgroup is not graduating. Obviously, we need to do more for those with limited English proficiency. And one of the problems we have in this subgroup is that it's really a moving target. We need better data. If you were to miraculously have students come in that unable to speak English at all, and in 6 months they're totally fluent, but they're no longer designated as limited English proficiency. If new people come in and have limited English proficiency, and then you test everybody, well, all of a sudden, it doesn't look like you made any progress. You had the same number of people, limited English proficiency, the same scores one year as the next. You need to show some growth to see what happens to these limited English proficiency students over the course of time. If you are successful in getting them into fluent English in a short period of time, you ought to get scored on that. But unfortunately, you have people coming in at all grade levels, and unless you're tracking each individual student to see how the students are doing, the results are meaningless. So we need better data. But the point that you have made, that the overall graduation rate is it seems to be okay, but those with limited English proficiency is substantially lower. That achievement gap needs to be addressed. You need a credible plan to do something about it. But we actually need better data to show what is happening on a student level to see for each student how long does it take them to become fluent in English. And because if you have a continual influx of students, you need to show that you are actually improving each individual student, even though the overall level of English proficiency may not be going up, because you've educated the students that are there and they're no longer part of the program, so the next year they don't get tested. So it looks like you didn't make any progress. So we need better data, but I think the point you've made is that there are subgroups that are way behind, and you need to make sure you have a credible plan to do something about it.
So, Congressman, I know that you have I know that the House schedule is starting to move in on you, and you're going to have to leave. Do you have time for one more question?
Depends on what it is.
Operator, could you put one more through? And
absolutely. Next caller, please go ahead.
Hi, Congressman. This is Susie Saavedra calling from the National Urban League. Thank you so much for stopping by our congressional briefing yesterday afternoon. My question is regarding next week. We know that Congress is going to be out for the district work period, which means that members are going to be in their home states. So I'm wondering if you could tell us what can we as advocates be doing to help improve the accountability provisions of the Senate's ESEA bill.
Well, one thing that you can do is to contact your members of the U.S. Senate and members of the House to ensure that students receive the support when they miss state-set goals for achievement graduation rates, and to ensure the high schools that fail to graduate a third or more of their students are identified for improvement, basically making sure that the accountability standard is there. The Urban League had a forum you referred to yesterday where they had a broad cross-section of civil rights organizations all pointing to the urgency of making sure that the accountability is there. So once you have determined that there's an achievement gap, you have to have a credible response to do something about it. Just can't publish it like we've been doing for the last 50 years. You have to actually do something about it. And making sure that that accountability is there, both with the achievement gaps and the graduation rates. I think if you can call your federal representatives, your members of the House and members of the Senate with that message, that would be extremely helpful.
So, Congressman, thank you very, very much. I know that you've got a schedule you have to keep, but thank you for taking this time. I want to thank Congressman Bobby Scott for his leadership, and I know that we can pass with that leadership an ESEA reauthorization that truly lives up to the aspirations and legacy that we want for it, and also provide our children the opportunity to graduate from high school, college, and career ready. So, Congressman, thank you. I'm going to give a few more pieces of information, but I know that you have to run, so I just want to say thank you very, very much.
So thank you, Bob, and thank you for your leadership.
And so to those on the call, you've heard reference to a report that the Alliance has issued. If you're interested in seeing how many high schools are failing to meet the graduation or failing to graduate at least a third of it's how many high schools have at least a third of their students dropping out or more. The report is called Below the Surface, Solving the Hidden Graduation Rate Crisis. And you can find it at the Alliance website, www.allfored.org/ESEA. And that's Congressman Scott was referring to that as well as other reports. And for other regular updates on ESEA, please tune in to the Alliance's Federal Flash. That's our weekly video series on what is happening in federal education policy, and it comes to you in 5 minutes or less. You get it all in 5 minutes or less. You can receive an email when the next episode of the Federal Flash is available by emailing us, alliance@allfored.org. Let me just stress, this is a critical time. That's why we're so fortunate to have Congressman Scott. If the Senate takes up this bill next week, it will largely write the accountability provisions that I believe will be included in a final NCLB. Then obviously the activity switches to the House, but it could be well influenced by what happens in the Senate. So that is why this discussion was so timely and important, and why those of you who want to take action, this is the time to be doing it, particularly over the 4th of July district work period. So I want to thank everyone for joining us today. Have a great day.
And that does conclude today's conference. Thank you all for your participation.